Goma is at the base of a giant volcano that erupted about 10 years ago and destroyed much of the city. We're really inspired to be able to bring services to people that needed it.
Out of the lab and into the home, Eric Douglas went from the wilds of Rwanda, where he built technology to make scientists' lives easier, to selling products in the United States to make parents' lives easier. I'm Lisa Soonan.
And I'm David Shaywitz. This is Tectonics, the podcast focused on the people and passion at the intersection of technology and health.
Hey, David. Good to be here with you again today. How do you feel about that Apple Research Kit announcement?
You know, I'm incredibly excited about it. I think that the whole key next step for precision medicine is really being able to measure dynamic phenotype, you know, how we are, not just the time when we're in the clinic or in an isolated moment, but to get a much broader sense of how we experience life. And I think that's what's so exciting about digital health. And I'm very excited about the opportunity of the technologies that we'll be able, I hope, to interface with a research kit and be able to really advance the study of phenotype in a much more complete way.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I was talking to my daughter about it last night, who's an incredible expert in healthcare and statistics at the age of 19. And when I was explaining the research kit to her, she said to me, there's going to be terrible bias in that data. I've only taken one statistics class, but I think I know enough to know that. That was her quote. And she's right. I mean, I think it's really interesting because on the one hand, I agree with you. It's so incredibly valuable to be able to get all that data for the first time. And I think I've already read that something like 50,000 people have signed up to contribute data already in a week. But on the other hand, you know, it's all going to be people who make, you know, $150,000 who can afford to buy the watch or the whatever. And on top of that, self-selection. So what do you think about that issue?
Right. Well, I think it's important not to have the perfect be the enemy of the good here. I think that ultimately a lot of the technologies that start off narrowly defined wind up getting much broader applications. And I think this is going to be something like that. I think that the technologies that you're going to be able to develop to measure and to assess people and to be able to do it ideally in a relatively non-invasive, non-intrusive way, some of them sure may start off in a very narrow group of very early adopters and maybe, you know, with that aren't going to be representative. But the hope is that as the technology develops and becomes cheaper, it'll wind up becoming, it's critically important that it winds up diffusing into the entire population.
Well, it's interesting opportunity for sure. I think, you know, it's an incredible opportunity for do-it-yourself medicine in a way that we haven't seen before. And I think it's a great transition to what we're going to talk about today, actually. So I'm going to start by introducing our guest. You know, many people who work in the medical industry come to it for personal reasons. For scientist and hardware hacker Eric Douglas, hardware hacker by his own statement.
It's a compliment.
He started helping diagnose patients in the remotest parts of Africa and Asia. And for him, that was a really pivotal moment because it led him to realize he could use what he learned to make a difference at home. Fast forward, and he's now CEO of CellScope, a company on the forefront of home diagnostics and telemedicine. And it's great to have Eric sitting right here next to me at Tectonics.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, well, we're incredibly excited to have you. So maybe we'll start off by just trying to ask how you sort of, one, connect those two different experiences where you started off in EE at Purdue, at Berkeley, UCSF, building these sort of sophisticated diagnostic tools for personalized or precision or whatever the word of the day is, medicine. And you were doing all the stuff in remote areas of India, Uganda, Vietnam to work on ID. And now you're sort of helping kids, parents in San Francisco helping figure out if their kids have ear infections. How did you go from one to the other? What was the connection?
Yeah, I think it's been a process of simplification and getting more applied. In grad school, it was about lab on a chip microfluidic devices and developing these tools that could be really powerful, that could be taken out into the field to do point of care diagnosis. But the actual application and turning that into a product was going to be a few years into the future.
When did you even first get interested in health? I mean, how did you sort of pick that to go into? I mean, if you were interested in technology, I would imagine your friends were doing games or something else kind of cool, you know, that sort of seemed more cool or trendy. How did you wind up in health, of all things?
Well, as a EE undergrad, you know, I love the tools of engineering and electrical engineering. I love being able to make devices and sensors and But I wasn't excited about the applications. I started actually off in computer engineering, and I wasn't excited about computer architecture or making chips faster. I was excited about using those tools to make an impact, to do something better for people. And one of the kind of personal factors there was I have a brother who's blind. And one of the first projects I got to work on was as an undergrad research assistant in a lab at Johns Hopkins that was making a retinal prosthesis. And so it was really exciting to think about how I could start to apply those tools to really make a difference in people's lives.
That's so interesting. So that was the first project you work on, the retinal prosthesis?
Yeah.
And what happened to that?
It's still going. So that lab has moved to USC now, and it's turning into a product.
Really? Wow. Are you still involved with it?
I haven't been, no, but I've been watching the progress. It's exciting.
And have you been able to leverage your experience and your work in the field to help your brother?
Not directly yet. More just as a motivator. But you know, as we think about other applications for CellScope and getting beyond ears into other types of imaging, I think helping my brother Luis and other people like him is part of what drives me.
So interesting. It's such an interesting thing to me that almost everybody who comes to healthcare and starts a company has some sort of personal story that drives them there. It's really a common thread, which you don't see in gaming, like, or if you do, they think, God, keep it to themselves. What led you from that to the public health world, to going out, out into the wilds of Africa and Asia?
Well, I think it was wanting to make things that we could actually bring to market, wanting to make tools that, as I was working in the retinal prosthesis lab, it was very exciting, but it was a few years in the future. It was something that is still in the process of being productized now. And as I continued both through grad school and then through my postdoc, wanting to really get to tools that we could make into products now, that we could actually take out to patients, take out to users, and have it do some good.
Do you remember the first time you went to one of these countries and experienced it? Could you tell us what that was like, where you sort of bring your experience of sort of the Western perspective of how one imagines, what technology is for, and contrasting that to the experience when you're actually there and seeing how life is lived?
Sure, yeah. So there's, I think, a couple experiences. So I mentioned my brother, Luis. So his name's Luis. He's adopted from Brazil. I have another sister who's adopted from Brazil as well. And so, I, from a young age, had a pretty global perspective on what life is like in a lot of developing world settings. And
the first, so you could help explain to people how the World Cup works and things like that.
That's right. Yeah, it comes in handy. But in an actual kind of research setting, probably the first time was when I took one of our early CellScope prototypes to Congo, and I was in a city called Goma on the border of Rwanda, and working in a hospital there, a really amazing hospital called Heal Africa, that deals with a lot of the ongoing results of the conflict there, and just seeing the way that people are making do with the resources that are available, really kind of scrapping things together, and being so resourceful and being so ingenious with what they have in front of them.
Because at first blush, it seems completely incongruous to show up to say, "Oh, we're going to help you all out, and here's our iPhone 6 or whatever at the time."
Yeah,
that'd be nice if we could plug it into a wall. We don't have one of those either.
That's right. Well, it was interesting
because they got the wall technology figured out, but I don't know about the power.
It's the sort of thing where the one piece of really reliable infrastructure there was the wireless network, was the cell network, and so taking advantage of that, the charging and other kind of consumables is still a challenge. But the roads were poor. There's not a lot to rely on. A city like Goma. So Goma is at the base of a giant volcano that erupted about 10 years ago and destroyed much of the city. And so it's got a lot of problems, but still got pretty good cell access. And so we're really inspired to be able to use that to be able to bring services to people that needed it.
I know you traveled around. You went to India, I think, as well, and Vietnam and Uganda and other places. What was the focus of your efforts there, all focused on the CellScope kind of technology, or were there other things going on?
That work and some of those, a lot of those studies were also with other folks in our lab at Berkeley, going to Uganda and Vietnam. Those were focused around CellScope.
So what did you learn there? What did you bring back to the U.S. healthcare system that you learned over there?
So at that point, it was the research project from the lab at Berkeley. So Professor Dan Fletcher leads the group, and we were really focused on high magnification microscopy, doing things like sputum smears or blood smears for tuberculosis or malaria diagnosis. And I think a couple of both positive and negative lessons. We learned that these tools could be really powerful, could be really valuable. We could make it easy enough for someone with limited training in the field to be able to take a blood smear, put it onto a little capillary that's already loaded with the dye, and put it into the device. I think that some of the negative lessons were, we had to make it really easy. We had to make it so that it didn't require a lot of infrastructure, didn't require a lot of consumables or reagents. Also that even sending the data offsite to be diagnosed still wasn't going to make it easy. That, you know, that was one bottleneck we were getting through, but we still needed to find a remote expert to be able to connect the data to. We still needed to find out a way to set up the right incentive or set up the right interest for them to want to make that diagnosis. So that's where, you know, as we've gotten now more into making the products, trying to make it even simpler, to, you know, to make it so that folks at home can use it, to make it easy to take images, to make it easy to collect the data, and set it up in the system right so that everybody can benefit.
Can you help set the scene a little bit? I mean, you know, you guys get off the plane, you have this technology, you show up. What is it like when you start to meet with some of the folks there and you sort of, you know, open, like Wizard of Oz, like open your bag of tricks and show the stuff? Are they like, thanks, that's just what we needed? Or are they excited? Or I really don't know what that's like.
Sure.
I'm kind of curious.
Sure. So in the tuberculosis example, so we, you know, in Goma, working at this hospital, you know, it was the regional site where they were doing a lot of tuberculosis analysis, and they had a microscope, they had someone who was doing sputum staining microscopy, but it was a very laborious process, a cumbersome process. They had, you know, racks of slides that they had to go through, and they had basically just one person who knew how to do that analysis. And so it was the sort of thing where we were able to go and get a lot of great feedback on what we should change and how we should reconsider it. But we learned definitely that we couldn't just take the product or the prototype that we had made in the lab and just plop it down into their facility.
It occurs to me that we should tell our listeners exactly the product you're talking about, because we haven't done that yet. So maybe you could take us a moment and tell us what CellScope's product actually is.
Okay, sure. So CellScope broadly is trying to bring medical imaging to the smartphone for health. And our first product is in ear infection. So ear infection is the most common reason kids go to the doctor. And what we can do with our system, it's a hardware attachment that goes on the phone that turns it into an otoscope. And then families at home can use our device, use our app on the phone in conjunction with our hardware to record a video of the child's ear, send it up to a doctor for diagnosis, and then receive that, a treatment plan, a prescription if necessary, all from home.
And if you were able to see the product, those of you listening to this, it's about the size of a Brock's caramel, if you've ever seen one of those. It's a little square. If you go on the CellScope website, you can check it out. But it's quite amazing little attachment, and allows you to, just like an otoscope, like a doctor would use, look in the ear and see the drum and all of that, yes?
And fits into a couple of current themes. It fits into, obviously, I think you're backed by Koeschler, right?
That's right.
And sort of, you know, a lot of his ideas of being able to really sort of empower people through digital technology. And also, it's something that Eric Topol has talked about extensively in his new book, where he views the smartphone specifically as something that's going to empower people and cause a revolution akin to what the printing press did with centuries ago. When you sort of think about all those themes, is that sort of to contribute to your thinking, or is it like, oh, that's all great, but we have these very specific problems to solve?
No, I think those themes really do push it forward. I think, so we want to be able to solve the specific problems, but we want to be able to use that in kind of a positive feedback cycle so that, for example, we can get the device out there, get feedback from the users, get data from the users, and use that to improve the tools, make it easier to use. For example, the automated guidance feature we have in our app right now,
which is really cool. We were just seeing it right before the meeting, where, you know, you stick the thing in your ear, and usually, I mean, it's hard for doctors even initially when they're training to try to find that tympanic membrane, right? But with this CellScope thing, it actually guides the user, hopefully not through the tympanic membrane.
It's like Google Maps for eardrums.
Like Google Maps for eardrums. That's right. Trademark the Asusuna. But it's actually like you can imagine, you know, because one of the issues is, okay, here's sort of a, you know, how do you walk the line between a medical technology and then something that, you know, people can use without having all the training? You know, you think about what they do for some of these AEDs, like on an airplane, sure, or an airport, where they try to make it simple enough that you can use it.
Yeah.
But sir, could you give us an example of where you've seen someone, you know, how you've seen someone, a story of someone responding to your product for the first time?
Yeah. I think, because it is such a common problem for families, you know, there are about 5 million kids in the U.S. that get 3 or more ear infections per year. And so, you know, when we initially kind of put out a call for families who are in that camp, we got back hundreds of responses, people wanting to try the product and pilot it. And so we recruited about 100 of those folks to be early users for us. And just the feedback we got from them about the peace of mind, the saving the worry, the, you know, especially if they live in a remote area, if they live in, you know, I'm from Michigan, if it's the middle of the winter, when you're needing to drive across town.
And I've heard of winter, yeah.
Saturday night, you know, the doctor's office isn't open, you need to find an urgent care or ER. It's just, it's such an amazing thing for us to hear the feedback of people actually responding to it and you know, solving that problem.
So what are the challenges you're experiencing, though, getting physicians to put down their old school otoscope, say, don't bother coming in, just send me a picture, yeah, you know, and accept this as a legitimate tool?
Yeah, I think a lot of it goes away when they actually see it and try it. You know, they we've got a version for doctors and a version for home users. And a lot of doctors, you know, once they use it themselves, so, you know, doctors using it in the clinic, you know, people aren't too averse to that. They'll mm-hmm. they'll try it out. They'll say, oh, you know, it's a digital otoscope. Why not?
Yeah, they still get paid that way.
And then, you know, you know,
truth hurts.
that's a great bridge, because people like really, really enjoy that, especially pediatricians.
Unlike the VCs who do it for charity. Sorry, I had to walk into the middle of this, Eric. It can get ugly.
Yeah. being able to show it to the family, show it to the patient, have that patient engagement really makes a big difference. And so having them use it themselves really helps. And then from that, a lot of them move on to say, hey, I've got a few families that might benefit from this. Mm-hmm. I'll send it home.
That's an interesting question, as you were alluding to. How do you sort of get to the tipping point where it becomes less sort of like a novelty, where people will use it for a little bit and either get it into routine use in a clinic or routine use at home? And I know this is something that one often hears about, for example, with other cell phone, other smartphone attachments. I know that Eric Topol is very excited about the idea of being able to use to turn a cell phone into a sort of like a cardiac echo machine. And he said he doesn't use his regular stethoscope anymore. He purely uses, it sounds like, the smartphone-enabled one. On the other hand, I think there are probably maybe one person I know, Eric, who does that, or, you know, a handful of people. So, you know, how do you – but clearly, if you want to be successful, you have to really cause this tectonic shift. How do you do that?
Sure. Well, I think there's different answers for doctors and home users. I think for doctors, you know, many of them will probably be just as happy with their standard otoscope. You know, they've been using it for decades, and they don't have a problem with it. So I think the opportunity there is to show them maybe a slightly better way to do it, a way to be able to capture the data, record it, share it with their patients, have a longitudinal record, be able to compare it to last times they measured, and so on. For the home users, it's very different. In the home use case, you know, it's on the one hand trying to show them a capability they've never seen before, but it's a problem they know they have. And that's really the way we approach it. And that's, you know, it's not just here's a hammer, anybody have a nail. You know,
right.
It's developing a technology that, like, ear infection is such a common problem, and so finding the people for whom it is a regular, real irritant, you know, they're going once a month, their kids have tubes, it's, you know, they're having to take off work, all the problems they have with it, and offering it to them. And we don't have to sell it very hard to them because they know they have a real problem with it.
So I was one of those kids. I had the chronic ear infection thing. I had the tubes. I had all that. Oh, wow. And, yeah, I remember even that. I mean, believe it or not, I can remember back that far, you know, and the experience of having to go to the doctor all the time and you know, it I can only imagine how much of a relief this would be to parents. But on the other hand, I would also think that a lot of parents are afraid to be the ones making the decision about whether you should go to the doctor because they're worried about their kids. And I've also played the role of neurotic mother, so
sure.
I know how that goes. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's why we connect them to a doctor. So they can. It's basically the evolution of the nurse call center. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be you would call and talk to the nurse or maybe the doctor on the phone, and he or she would respond and help you understand if you should come in. You know, now we can just give them better tools to interact remotely. And so
do you provide that? Because one of the things that has occurred to me in both of the settings as that you were talking about was for it to work in the hospital, a lot of it's going to depend on sort of the IT or the infrastructure background. You know, being able to record something and being able to sort of, oh, this is useful if you can immediately download and stick it in the EMR, less so if you sort of really can't. You know, if that documentation is useful. And then for the home use, like you're describing, you know, if you're able to, if the upshot of it is, okay, we're going to allow the remote diagnosis, if the rest of the system isn't built up, and, you know, are you too ahead of your time? How do you deal with that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. It's, you know, we're certainly like right on the edge of our time, I think. You know, a lot of those things are hard. It's an emerging field, and you know, we can't wait for all the EMRs to be ready. We can't wait for all the, you know, payment systems to be ready. We have to push forward with it and try and demonstrate the value and hope that we can can get those parties going at the same time.
So you went from a scientist, you know, a really intense scientist at Berkeley, and allow me to say at this moment, go Bears.
Go Bears.
To a CEO of a company, which is a big change. How is that change for you? What is that like? What were the biggest things you had to learn and unlearn?
Yeah, it's certainly
that was a very deep breath here, by the way.
Well, it's been a great learning experience. I think I think it screens for somebody who's comfortable with uncertainty.
Huh.
At least in my case, you know, being able to move from one thing to the next and not have to feel like I'm an expert in it before I jump into it. And that's, I mean, that's kind of what grad school's like, right? Like, you come into grad school, you start, you learn a bunch of stuff, and then you do some experiment nobody's ever done before, and then you hope you can show that it's been useful.
There's so many more parameters, though, in the business world, aren't
there? Sure, yeah. Yeah, and it's, you know, oftentimes, just as soon as I get good at one part of it, then it opens up a whole new part of it. You know, initially, the work was a lot around R&D of the initial product, and then it was around product development, and now it's more about building the business and growing the team. And so, yeah, I'm having to learn very fast, but it's a really fun experience.
So how is it, what are the differences in working for the money that comes from a group like COSLA to from the money that came from a group like Gates Foundation for the clinical work you were doing overseas? Is it a different set of expectations?
Well, I think they both have a pretty futuristic view of development. You know, I think the Gates Foundation obviously has a big picture, you know, wants to make this whole society, whole world level change. And, you know, that's the exciting work they do, where just bringing so many projects, so many kind of far-flung, far-fetched scientific ideas and supporting them from the beginning is really a really powerful enabler. In the same way, I think the Coastal Ventures, you know, does a lot of great investments in companies like ours that, you know, maybe early on wasn't as obvious that, you know, as we were in the first class of Rock Health and, you know, back in 2011, when digital health wasn't as common of a term as it may be today, you know, we went and pitched to a lot of VCs, and the healthcare guys didn't like the IT, and the tech guys didn't like the healthcare, and being able to, you know, have an investor that takes a longer view has been really helpful.
So this was part of Coastal's grand vision to replace doctors with computers. Is that it?
I can't speak for Coastal on that, but you know, we.
But can you replace doctors with computers? What's your view?
Well, we're not trying to replace doctors. I think we're trying to give everybody better tools.
Mm-hmm.
You know, both.
I mean, it seems to be much more in sort of the minute clinic kind of a model, where you're sort of allowing doctors to practice at the top of their license, you might say.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Helping doctors practice more effectively, you know, and also moving some of the care sort of down the spectrum, either from, you know, a primary care setting into a retail clinic or into the home, and letting those practitioners be able to be more powerful.
So one topic that I think that really interested both Lisa and also me is that for the products that you sell to home users, right? My understanding is that the people who buy these are almost 100% women. Is that right? For the that your purchasers are 100% women, and so there's been a lot that's made about who should be designing products, and in a lot of technology companies there's sort of this issue where you have a bunch of guys sitting in a room trying to figure out what do women want,
what should the next tampon look like.
Right. Now you have a different situation because your co-founder, right, Amy, right? I mean, you've developed this with your co-founder Amy Sheng, who's talked a lot about this. What are your thoughts on the topic, and how have you sort of worked together? And how have you, do you feel like that's a specific issue in designing products with knowing that most of the purchasers, from what I understand, are women?
I think it's, you know, Amy's a terrific partner. It's been really, you know, fantastic working with her as a co-founder. I think the perspective of having that direct experience of being the, you know, lead health officer of the home makes a big difference. You know, in a lot of cases, that is the mother. And so, you know, wanting to be able to talk to as many moms as we can, both in the company and outside the company, but dads too. I think, you know, any parents that have that responsibility, are the ones that we're trying to get the insight from and really understand.
Do you feel like the perspective is different than that there's something, okay, here's like a 20-something programmer is not going to understand that your sort of management team brings to this? And your design team?
I do. I think probably the main thing is that urgency is maybe the first time parent fear is the middle of the night wake up. You know, a lot of the on-demand delivery services, the on-demand economy that's emerging right now is about convenience, you know, kind of upscale 20 and 30 somethings in the Bay Area getting their favorite sushi right away. And that's great. Like, I got really good food delivered last night with one of those services. But
happy to hear.
But you know, it's different. It's not a visceral experience. And you know, having a crying child, having a healthcare concern at home is a need that is really deeply felt. And so having the insight in the company and outside the company of people that can really help us understand that as we develop the product is essential.
Have you heard back from moms or dads about how this changed their experience? Is there a story you can tell about that?
So many stories of that peace of mind, of that that middle of the night wake up, where, you know, for example, one of our early users had the device and she was saying that she was, you know, it was the classic, really the classic case that we designed for, and she kind of parroted it back to us, which is exactly what we wanted to hear. It was Saturday night, it was 2 a.m., the child woke up crying, she didn't know what to do, she was going to call and make an appointment on Monday at the pediatrician's office, and then she remembered she had this weird thing in her medicine cabinet that she had signed up for. And so she went and grabbed it and took an image of her child's ear and was able to, you know, the doctor called her back in about 30 minutes and got that peace of mind and really, you know, was able to rest more well assured.
And do you find that there's some, have you heard stories or people that are reluctant, that makes them nervous to do this? What keeps people from doing this?
Yeah.
That's a great question.
So people often aren't, you know, they've been conditioned that the doctor does the doctor stuff. And, you know, especially for part of the reason a lot of our early users are these high-frequency ear infection families is that they've by necessity had to break through that preconception. They're you know, feeling the pain. They just can't go immediately to the doctor every time their child cries and tugs at his ear. And so some of them have bought their own simple otoscopes for the home to look in their child's ear. So really, you know, it's easier to break through that preconceived notion once they've really felt the pain. But it's also, you know, designing the tool to make it easier. So, you know, making it so we can take video, making it so we can guide them through the process, the softer tips, you know, trying to get around the things. We've got a wax detector feature that's coming.
Ooh, yummy.
We can, you know, help to get around some of those fears.
Huh. So do you think that I think this is kind of an interesting special case because people whose kids have chronic ear infections get exhausted from dealing with it. They're dealing with it constantly, right? But do you think that in general, beyond those extreme circumstances, consumers are ready to spend money on healthcare products? Because by and large, they haven't in the past.
Sure. I think that we need products like this to help show them why they should spend money on it and to give them those real consumer experiences. We need to give them, you know, make them think that their money was well spent.
I mean, is the future of this something like, you know, you could, to your point, for people who don't have chronic ear infection, is the idea that ultimately there'll be sort of like 10 attachments that you stick on, and even if you don't think your kids are going to get one, the same way you have a first aid kit in your home, maybe you'll have something with 10 attachments or whatever it is, and if there's some issue, it's sort of a natural reaction to attach the right one, get some kind of image or sound or something, and then sort of have that as an initial interaction with the healthcare system.
Home colonoscopy, for instance.
Sure.
For your kid.
Well, maybe they piss
That's
you
right.
off.
Well, it's sort of the evolution again of something like searching the web for this information. Right. You know, right now what we do is just go look up the symptoms, you know, tugging at ear, crying too much, whatever, and you get some response. And that's a sort of forerunner to you put in some data, out comes some basic information about the health. We're trying to take that further by letting them have more actionable data. Take, in this case, an image or other symptoms that could be developed with sensors and have that go into the device, send it up to a doctor, be able to build up some tools for automated screening and analysis, and really help to you know, show initially with these acute, really, you know, painful pain points, but then have that kind of get people more comfortable with using these systems at home.
So, like the internet of waxy things. It'd be awesome. So, bringing it full circle, since you just mentioned data here, what happens with all that data you collect through CellScope? You got all those images, all that video, all the parent input.
Sure.
Do you own it? Do they own
it?
Who owns it? Yeah, really?
the patients own their own data.
Is that explicit in the agreements?
I think that's explicit in general policy, but.
Not really.
they own their own data, but then they share data with us, de-identified data, to be able to do research. And so developing tools, you know, I think really the key there is giving them back some benefit, showing that we can make tools that'll be more useful, that it's worth their trouble to want to engage in sharing data.
Do they volunteer their data? Do they tell you that, or do you ask them to volunteer their data? Is it actively consented that way?
Yes.
Interesting.
Cool.
That is cool. Well, we're coming to the end of our time here, and just want to thank you so much for coming in today and talking to us. It's been really fascinating.
It's terrific. Thank you so much, Eric.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Take care.